And Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Hannah Scott in for Dave Ross. And John Dickerson joins us from CBS's Face the Nation. You're going to have to lay out this new infrastructure deal for us. The president seemed pleased to announce that neither side is getting what they want.
That is what the president announced. And so in that way, it looks like what we might have recognized as an old-fashioned bipartisan deal. Neither side gets what they want, but both sides signs on to a piece of legislation because it contains largely a lot of things they do want. And so this might look like progress at a time when that has been difficult on complicated issues in Washington. The only problem is that the president, after saying this, announced that he wouldn't sign an infrastructure bill unless a reconciliation bill, a separate piece of legislation, also passed the Senate. Now, the second piece of legislation he tied it to is one that would require only 50 Democratic votes. But there is Democratic opposition from Senators Sinema and Manchin to passing a lot of legislation through reconciliation. And so the shape of that other bill is up for grabs. And this process of linking the two angers Republicans who would like to just vote on a bill itself. The reason the president is linking the two is because there's a lot in this new infrastructure bill that progressives don't like that he's put basically shifted over into this other piece of legislation. So the question is whether this linkage is going to knock the Republicans off of the bipartisan infrastructure bill that they've agreed to. And that's what we're going to find out in the next 24 hours. It already is causing quite a lot of consternation among Republicans who are saying, you're basically holding us hostage here by linking these two, linking the bill with all the stuff we don't like to this one that we've delicately agreed we might agree to. So this deal that looked like it happened yesterday may fall apart.
Ugh. Who has more power in the Senate right now, Mitch McConnell or Joe Manchin?
Well, that's an excellent question. To the extent that Mitch McConnell can get all of his Republicans to vote in unanimity, no matter the issue, he has the power because the threshold for anything complicated in the Senate is 60 votes, which means even if the president had all of his Democrats, he still has to get 10 Republicans. So Manchin has a lot of power in the sense that on the reconciliation bill, it requires 50 Democrats. And that means basically Democrats have to accept whatever Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema want. Sinema, the senator from Arizona, who is like Manchin in the positions she takes. So I think basically McConnell has more power, but Manchin has a good deal of power himself.
And switching gears now to the January 6th attack on the Capitol, Speaker Pelosi announced a select committee to investigate that attack on the Capitol. How is that any different from what the FBI is doing?
What the FBI is doing is prosecuting or helping lead, you know, gather evidence to prosecute and build cases against the individuals. A congressional investigation into this would go into all kinds of different areas, potentially. A fair-minded one would look at not only the security issues that caused the conditions that led to the mayhem, but then would also deal with the larger political question of how you incite a mob. And it's everybody is in agreement, Democratic leaders as well as Republican leaders, that the previous president, by telling lies, incited the mob. There is no disagreement on that. Republicans have tried to change the topic, but Leader McConnell and Leader McCarthy both have said that in their remarks. And that is an interesting and important political question to get at the heart of how that came about, what a healthy democracy can do to head off that from happening again. But those are issues that get delicate because the person that those two leaders said incited a riot is the leader of the Republican Party with a great deal of power, and the Republicans are going into an election in 2022 and they want to be unified. So those larger issues are what killed the bipartisan commission in the first place. And it'll be interesting to see how whatever select committee Speaker Pelosi creates handles those issues and what Republicans do in response.
That is an important, those questions you just mentioned are important for all Americans, I think, to understand and get to the bottom of. Do you think we get some sort of tangible results from any of the investigations going on?
Well, there will certainly be lots of tangible results in terms of the prosecution of individuals and the nuts and bolts of the laws that were broken and who allowed those laws to be broken. And then just the basic question of how to keep the Capitol safe from this kind of behavior. Those larger thematic American democratic questions are much more nettlesome and much more difficult, because obviously when you're talking about political questions, the politicians have an incentive to put aside their reason and instead deploy their political instincts. And, you know, that doesn't always lead to the best outcomes. But the questions at the heart of it are vital, because if you can't sort through the system you use to work out your disputes, then you just have ever escalating disputes. I mean, you have, and also you have to. And so what the question at the center of this is vital to a healthy democracy. Mm-hmm. But the problem is you have to have a healthy democracy in order to get to the center of those issues, and that's really the problem that will bedevil any special committee or bipartisan committee or whatever you might form.
Absolutely. But one of the Capitol police officers, Michael Fanone, was on CBS This Morning earlier this week, and he wanted to know if any members of Congress played a role in planning the attack. Is there any evidence of that?
There's some planning is a I haven't seen that evidence. There were members of Congress who gave escalating levels of encouragement. Now, that's very different in planning. And then also, you can encourage people who are protesting an outcome they don't like and think that's what you're doing, and not necessarily be inciting a mob to break into the Capitol. And so one's definitions of what encourage mean can get a little messy. But the investigation into whether someone helped plan it, I don't know where that really stands or if there's any real evidence on that. Although obviously, if there were, that would be quite a problem.
And then lastly, Vice President Kamala Harris is headed to the southern border. Do we know if she's meeting with Governor Greg Abbott? He has his own plans, I know, to build a border wall.
I don't think she is. I think she's meeting with aid workers and focusing on the humanitarian aspect of the migrant crisis. She's also working, meeting with border officials, law enforcement officials. But the focus and thrust of her meeting is much more on the kind of whole picture of immigration, the inflows from those Northern Triangle countries, and then less the kind of singular focus on the border wall and law enforcement, which is the kind of Abbott/Republican position. So this is unfortunately, because it's such a nettlesome problem, it's this visit has gotten pretty politically tinged, so that tends to make it hard to make actual substantive progress.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington. And
now time for our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. This week, a mysterious headstone from the 1880s that was found recently in Pierce County is the focus of a special reunion ceremony tomorrow in Buckley. Felix?
Good morning, Hannah. Yeah, there's a lot to this story, which I first read about in the Edumclaw Courier-Herald. Last fall in Bonnie Lake, a guy named Dustin Bichetti found a simple but ornate marble headstone laying on the ground in the woods near his home. Stood upright, it's about 2 feet tall and has a carved lamb at the top. I've got a picture of it on my Twitter feed. The name on the headstone is Daisy Kirtley, who was born in 1878 and died in 1886 when she was not quite 8 years old. It's pretty sad. It says the names of her parents and the words, "Rest, little Daisy, in happiness rest. Mingling with angels, we know thou art blessed." So word of the discovery spread on social media, and several people in the area began trying to figure out the origins of the headstone. It was truly a group effort. I spoke with one of the history sleuths, a guy named Shane Riley, who also works for the Army Corps of Engineers at Mud Mountain Dam. He credited the many people involved in tracking down the facts, and then he told me the knowns and the unknowns. So members of the Kirtley family were in this area as early as 1853. They were part of one of the early wagon trains to come over the treacherous Natchez Trail, which Daisy's future uncle, Whitford Kirtley, had actually helped build. The family also spent time back in Missouri, which is where Daisy was born in 1878. In 1885, her parents homesteaded right in the middle of what's now Lake Taps. Now, I knew Lake Taps was an artificial lake that had been built, you know, about 100 or so years ago, but I didn't know it's actually made up of four smaller lakes, one that was called Taps, but also Crawford Lake, Church Lake, and Kirtley Lake, which is named for Daisy's family. Now, we don't know why Daisy died, but the theory is she was buried near Kirtley Lake, and her grave there was marked with a recently found headstone. But the Kirtley family moved closer to Buckley around 1900, and the homestead, the place where Daisy is likely still buried, was flooded after 1909 when the larger Lake Taps was created as part of a hydropower project. So we also don't know when the headstone was moved, or where it was for the last 112 years. That's a big mystery. Or why it was found not only many miles from its original location on the bottom of Lake Taps, but also many miles from where the Kirtleys had moved to Buckley back in 1900. We'll probably never know the answer to those questions. But there is something of a happy ending to all this. As it turns out, much of Daisy's family, including her parents, James and Mary, and her brothers, Bluford and Fleming, are buried in the Buckley Cemetery. You know, they had moved to Buckley in 1900. And now, thanks to the efforts of a bunch of people down in that area, the Weeks Funeral Home in Buckley, the Greater Bonnie Lake Historical Society, and the Foothills Historical Museum, Daisy's headstone will be formally reunited with her family. They're going to set it in stone next to a marker for her and her other family members. And this is all going to happen tomorrow. That's Saturday at 10 o'clock at the Buckley Cemetery. It's open to the public. And now Shane Riley, you know, his contribution to this, he figured out that the Kirtley family had been involved with the Natchez Trail, which is, you know, it's one of these efforts to bring wagons over the mountains. It was a very treacherous route. It didn't end up being as popular as other easier ways to get across the Cascades. But he also tracked down several of Daisy Kirtley's descendants. There's some great grandnieces that still live in the area. And at least two of them are going to be at the ceremony tomorrow in Buckley. Now, it's unfortunate it's going to be so hot tomorrow. otherwise, I might consider getting in the car and driving down there, because it's so strange that this headstone just turned up in the woods. Who knows where it has been, whether somebody had it and just dumped it out there, or it was actually uncovered by something we don't know about. But the fact these people at the funeral home and the people at the historical societies are willing to put in the effort and put together this little ceremony and actually formally rededicate this thing and reunite, if not the grave and the remains, at least the headstone of young Daisy Kirtley with her family members who are there at the Buckley Cemetery.
That's an amazing story, Felix. What do you think happened?
Oh, boy. You know, one theory is that maybe some construction in the area turned this up, and that stuff just, someone thought, oh, let's just put this in the woods because we don't know what to do. We don't want to go through official channels. Wow. There's a lot of, not exactly controversy, but people down in the Buckley and Bonnie Lake and Lake Taps area are very interested in this story, because it just says a lot about the early settlement of that area and how we treat the remains and how we remember the history and keep the stories alive. And when there's an artifact like this, it just stirs up so much. I mean, it's a perfect example. And the fact it can be rededicated and put next to the family members' headstones, that's a nice, probably the happiest ending possible given so many unknowns.
Sure, absolutely. And great that they found some relatives to be there even in that heat.
All right, thank you. Wear sunscreen.
Exactly. All right, thanks, Felix. Appreciate that.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Well, things are opening up, getting back to normal, except for some places which still have the plastic up and are still doing sanitizing, even sometimes spraying disinfectant around. And Mark Fisher, who writes for the Washington Post, talked to a number of disease experts who told you, Mark, that all this surface sanitizing going on is basically a waste of soap. So what are we talking about here?
Well, I think we're doing more to disinfect our soul, perhaps, than to disinfect anything that would hurt the actual virus. What's happening here is a kind of what a lot of people call hygiene theater. It's meant to get across the idea that people should be more calm and more at ease with going out than they were during the lockdown period. It really doesn't have anything to do with curbing the spread of COVID-19. The science has become clear over the last year that this is not a virus that spreads through touch. It's a virus that spreads through the air. And so all of these precautions that we see at places of business, at arts institutions, sports facilities, and so on, from temperature checks to the constant disinfecting of surfaces, are really more a psychological tool, it now turns out, than it is any effort to actually keep us healthy.
Okay, so whose psyche are we protecting here? Is it the customer's psyche, the business owner's psyche, the regulator's psyche? Whose?
Well, I think it's meant to make the customers less anxious and make them more willing to go out and spend money again. The problem is that all of these precautions that don't have anything to do with science are actually sending the wrong message. What they're doing is they're telling unvaccinated people that they're safe to move about without their masks on, which is the wrong message. The right message is if you've been vaccinated, you don't need that mask anymore, and you don't need all of these extra precautions. But these kinds of precautions tend to linger for a long time after the immediate danger is gone. Think about the period after 9/11.
Yes.
We still have a lot of those precautions out there, even though they're totally unnecessary.
Yeah. But, I'll tell you, I know that's been called security theater for a long time. But, frankly, it makes me feel safer. And if it's theater, okay. Because as many politicians have said, the bad guys only have to be right once. So, you know.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And in fact, calling it hygiene theater or security theater, it might sound derisive or insulting, but it's really not, because psychology is a very important part of this. And there are a lot of business owners, as well as psychologists and others, who are saying, yes, it's hygiene theater, but that's okay, because we really do need to calm people, and we really do need to keep things clean. And so if we're taking more care to prevent the spread of all viruses and colds and flus and all of that, that's a good thing too. But it's not for the purpose of curbing COVID-19, which we know does not transmit that way.
Right. And as you point out, it also can be harmful in that if it causes unvaccinated people to think they can travel around without a mask, that could be dangerous.
Exactly. That's the real problem here. So, you know, to the extent that it is a little bit insulting to tell people that they're engaging in hygiene theater, there is a reason for that. And that is, as you say, that unvaccinated people really do need to hear the message that they are in danger of contracting this virus and of spreading it if they're not wearing a mask. And right now, hardly anybody's wearing a mask in this country,
yeah.
And whether it's signs on the front of stores or just people's behavior and seeing others go on mask, feeling liberated, everybody's on board with that. And unfortunately, more people are on board with that than should be.
Okay, let me ask you another aspect of this, though, because while COVID-19 is clearly not spread by touch, other diseases are, and COVID is not the only disease out there. So even if it's not necessary for COVID, could you justify it as a way of just deterring the spread of disease in general?
Absolutely. And that's where we get into what's really a judgment call. And everybody has to reach their own level of comfort. You have to balance that protection against colds and all sorts of other diseases versus your comfort and your enjoyment of life. So if you're someone who's annoyed by touchless condiment dispensers at the ballpark that don't really work, or that flood your hot dog with a giant plop of mustard, then maybe you would rather that they go back to the old machine that worked, where you press the button. Similarly, you might be annoyed by a temperature check at the front of a restaurant. It doesn't really do anything to keep you safe, but it might make you feel safe, and that's okay for some people. The question is, how as we as society, how do we come to some sort of middle ground where we're at the right balance point between comfort and protection from disease?
Did you have your hamburger ruined by a touch-free ketchup dispenser? Is that what happened here?
No, I didn't, but I heard from a lot of fans at the ballpark who did and who are really annoyed by this. And they think that there's a contradiction. You have all these devices, cashless ordering and people who have the touchless condiment dispensers, all of which are meant to keep people safer. But what they end up doing is causing larger crowds to gather because people can't figure out the machine or people are getting frustrated. And so it's counterproductive. So that's what I think has a lot of people miffed.
Okay. You're okay, though, with like, sneeze guards and, you know, glass barriers at the delicatessen and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think everybody's pretty much okay. I haven't seen a groundswell of grassroots opposition to sneeze guards. But I have seen a real grassroots opposition to these temperature checks that are as every bit as silly as the guard in the office building lobby demanding that you show an ID, any old ID. Doesn't even matter if it's yours. Nobody really looks at it. So that sort of pointless, mindless theater, I think, is what people find annoying.
Mark Fisher at the Washington Post. Mark, thank you.
Great to be with you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here to update us on post-pandemic travel is CBS travel editor Peter Greenberg. For one thing, the $10 billion that airlines are holding, and these are trips that were paid for but not taken. What's the status of that?
Yes, they're still holding on to it. It violates an existing U.S. Department of Transportation rule that's been on the books way before the pandemic that says that anytime an airline cancels your flight for whatever reason, you're entitled to an entire refund of your money, even if you bought a non-refundable ticket. When the pandemic broke out, a lot of airlines weren't behaving properly. They weren't disclosing this to passengers. They were, you know, basically offering them vouchers or credits, which in many cases either expired or they couldn't use. The U.S. Department of Transportation had gotten the largest number of complaints in recent history about refunds that passengers weren't able to get. U.S. Senators Markey and Blumenthal have already written letters to these CEOs of the airlines claiming that legislation could be pending if they don't play by the rules. Last week, the first salvo was fired by the U.S. Department of Transportation when they announced a $25.5 million fine, an enforcement action that's pending against one airline in particular, that's Air Canada. And that's sending a very clear signal to the other airlines that they could be next on the list.
So I didn't realize that. So they just decided unilaterally, contrary to law, that they were going to give vouchers instead of giving the money back.
That's right. Now, some airlines turned around later in terms of bad public opinion and started giving refunds when passengers asked for them, but they weren't really volunteering the fact that passengers had these rights.
If the airlines owe you money, do you have to do anything? Do you harangue them, or if you wait long enough, will your check show up in the mail?
Well, you can do a number of things if you want to go all the way to a small claims court case. But what's happening now is in the wake of the DOT ruling on the proposed fine against Air Canada, Air Canada is now proactively giving money back, even if you canceled the flight. They're trying to basically mitigate that fine. And that's a signal to the other airlines, which you're going to need to call them. You're going to need to contact them, remind them of that U.S. Department of Transportation rule, and have a conversation with somebody who can actually push the right button.
You brought up Air Canada, which reminds me, Canada is still closed to us?
It is. They've moved back the opening of their land borders till July 21st. They've done that every month since the beginning of the pandemic. Every month they push it back another month. They have a serious problem in getting their population vaccinated. They've already closed their ports through next February, which is why President Biden signed a waiver to allow for cruise ships to be able to bypass Canadian ports on their way to Alaska.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So Canada's problem is because of their vaccination rate, not ours?
That is correct.
I see. All right. That sounds strange because Canadians love government. I thought they would follow the government's advice. But now, do you know, I don't know if you know how much you know about the politics of Canada, but are these holdouts because they're anti-vaxxers or it's just availability or what is it?
It was availability. They were late in the game in getting the vaccinations going and actually getting the vaccines. There are only about 28% of Canadians that have been vaccinated already. It's not about an anti-vax movement. It's just not the supply.
Yeah, I see. All right. The other problem is staffing across the board, not just the airlines, but hotels and the rest of the hospitality industry. What's the status of that?
It is a huge problem. Hotels. I've been in three hotels in the last 3 weeks. One didn't have an entire housekeeping staff. One had one waitress in the restaurant. I mean, this is a serious problem, and it expands, as you say, to every area of the travel industry. It's hotels, it's airports, it's airlines. The TSA, is short 6,000 agents. They told us this 2 months ago. They haven't brought them on yet because they first have to hire them and find them. Then they have to train them. That's going to be a long time coming. Hotels are way below their availability of people that they have to have. And the airlines, that furloughed so many people, they're now asking for volunteers, at least Delta and American is, for their non-union management staff to go out to the airports and work counters and gates. That should tell you the situation there. And finally, the only guys, ironically, who are not having a problem are the cruise lines. They're fully staffed up. Their issue, though, is vaccinations of their crew and officers, because so many of their crew come from countries where those vaccinations aren't available. They've got to get the crew to ports where they can do that, and that's what they're doing now.
Yikes. I'm taking a flight next week. Now I'm worried. What are the conditions at airports like? Are they coping or not?
Well, they're not coping very well. The TSA is closing off a lot of security lines because they don't have the staff. Every plane is full, as you've already probably reported. My suggestion is simply this. Pick secondary and tertiary airports. Pick Oakland instead of San Francisco, Milwaukee instead of Chicago, Providence instead of Boston, and my favorite on the East Coast, Islip instead of LaGuardia. You will probably fare better.
On Long Island?
Absolutely. One of my favorite airports.
You mentioned the cruise industry. Now, are passengers going to come back, or are they still a little spooked?
Believe it or not, passengers are coming back in, I hate to use the expression, waves. They are because, remember, in 2019, 30 million Americans took a cruise, and most of those are repeat cruisers. They are very loyal. They have an entitlement issue with their ships. They love them. They can't wait to get back. And when they're putting the ships on sale for those cabins, they're selling them.
CBS travel editor Peter Greenberg. Peter, thank you.
You got it.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A father-son duo are turning a Father's Day journey into a summer-long celebration. CBS's Jamie Yukas has the story.
If life is a journey, James and Shepard Culver are certainly enjoying the ride.
7 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I'm trying to beat the heat.
It was 9-year-old Shepard's idea to pedal from Washington State to the Statue of Liberty.
I was like, well, that would take all summer, you know, and he's like, well, that actually sounds great, you know? We could spend all summer riding together.
Why not see the Statue of Liberty by going on an airplane or a train?
When you're on a bike, everything just slows down and you get to notice cool stuff on the side of the road.
Yeah, well,
they really had to slow down the first time they started the trek 2 years ago. In fact, they stopped.
I was feeling really, really sick, having terrible headaches while riding. My dad took me to the hospital, and a doctor poked my finger and said, sorry, Shepard, you have type 1 diabetes.
Now, with Shepard's insulin packed, the two are back on the road.
All right, on our way to
Devil's Lake.
Devil's Lake.
They've gone halfway and hope to get to New York by August.
What's been the highlight so far for you, Shepard?
Mostly just spending time with my dad.
Part of me is kind of dreading the fact that there's only 1,600 miles left. I'm going to feel pretty sad when we have to stop. I really had the time of my life here.
It doesn't get any better than that. Janie Yukas, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Good Friday morning. It is 6:47, and I'm Hannah Scott in for Dave Ross. Now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio. G Scott.
Oh, Hannah Scott, good morning. I love your last name.
Back at you, my friend. Back at you.
What are we talking about today? Happy Fresh Fridays to everybody that is listening. What are we talking about?
What else? The heat. Man. Did you hear the good news? It's Nick Allard says it's going to probably only be 106 now on Monday in Seattle, at least.
Man, here's what's the crazy part about that is, right? And I understand my great friend, wonderful friend, co-host Ursula, she questioned me. She had the audacity to say, gee, what bootleg app are you looking at to think that it's going to be 100 degrees this weekend? I'm like, Ursula, I'm looking at an app. Nobody questions somebody about an app that they're looking at with weather. Now, I understand, though. I understand because if you think about it, in 127 years, it's only hit over 100 four times.
We hit 104 about 10 years ago,
look,
I believe.
I remember where it was 2009. Me and my sons, I actually have a post about it. It was 2009. My sons, they were younger. all we did was watch Superbad every single day. Yeah, I'm probably not a great parent having my kids watch Superbad. But anyways, that's all we did. And I remember it was a hot. And so we all would have towels.
Oh.
And we have wet towels and we'd have them around our neck. And that's what we did.
But
it was
worked.
Super hot back in 2009.
Yeah.
So here it is. It's going to be hot this weekend. Everybody's going to be talking about how hot it is. Everybody's going to have all their remedies and what they're doing. And we all know it's too late to get air conditioners. We know that fans don't do nothing but blow hot air. So, again, you just do what you got to do. I just suggest maybe taking about 3-4 showers a day. And can we get something going forward now, that we should give deals on people to have air conditioner in the house? There is no way in the world, Hannah Scott, that we should have all this technology here in the Seattle area. We got Google, we got Microsoft, we got Amazon, we got all of the technology, the best technology in the country, but we all sweating and hot. How in the world are you going to do code and all this technology stuff and you hot and sweating?
I don't know, but I definitely think there should be a proposal, a bill, something so that we all have the air conditioning. Because as you said, there is none. I did find a couple of fans, though, at my place. I've
nice.
Got four strategically placed fans with the windows open, right? So they go, I don't know exactly what the term is for that, but it blows the air in exactly the right place because it is way too hot for me and my pets and my kid, everything here. Yeah. And I've got the ice thing that I keep that I put around my neck that I put in the freezer that helps me out a little bit.
Okay, here's what you do. You go to the movie theater, you go shopping and linger outside the ice cream section of the grocery store. You go to the movies. What else?
Ice skating.
Are the movies back?
I think movies are back, at least partially open. Find yourself a nice restaurant that's air conditioned.
I'm gonna tell you what.
Stay inside.
Hey, I know.
I
remember in 2009, right? And I was with my kids, and this is back when I was real broke. Anyways, I remember thinking like, I was like, man, I sure wish that I had some money to go get a hotel.
Oh,
you know what I mean? That would have been the best thing to do, but I wasn't able to do it. Then, have you guys talked about this? From what I read, aren't like 80% of the water fountains in the Seattle area not working anymore now because of COVID?
Yeah, they're trying to get half of them at least back up and running.
Like, what are the chances of that, right? So, I don't know. I guess my only PSA, now that I'm done being funny now, I'm trying to be serious, would be to check on your loved ones, check
Absolutely.
On the elderly in your neighborhood, check on your neighbors if there's someone that you know in your neighborhood that maybe lives alone. Just check on them. Make sure they're good. Ask them. Just knock on the door. Ask them if they need anything. I'm being serious when I say this because it's really serious. Make sure these pets are good. All the animals. Make sure if you thirsty, then they thirsty. You feel me? And a lot of times, and I don't know if you got as much fur as your body as these pets, but these pets got fur, so they hot. You know what I mean? So we want to make sure they're good. Please don't leave them outside. Don't leave them in cars. Maybe, you know what I mean? I don't even know if you just bring them in the car. Just don't even bring them in the car this weekend.
Yeah,
just leave them home.
Just common sense, people. Common sense.
Yeah, so it's going to be good. The good news is this. We'll get through it. It's sunny, the weather, and I want everybody to just be safe. Like, that's like the biggest thing as
well.
Yeah, and it's a tough weekend. Really high temperatures, tough for those who are living unsheltered as well. So the city has some weather shelters set up for folks as well. It's important to stay hydrated and, again, take care of those pets. I have a little pug, and he does not do well in the heat. So I have to keep him very moist and in the cooling area.
Yeah, we got another thing, too. I mean, it's going to be be careful with these. Hopefully, no fires happen over the weekend. Get a little dry and all that.
I think that 106 is going to kill that COVID. That's my thought. It doesn't stand a chance. Play outside, stay 6 feet apart. That COVID does not have a chance.
Yeah.
The fire hazard is real. They've got those warnings out.
That's
so
true.
Be smart. Don't flick your cigarettes. Don't put anything hot out there. Whatever you do, because that's the last thing we need is another major wildfire.
Don't
right
pull
now.
Your car up on a bunch of grass.
And get yourself a spray bottle. That's another
there
thing you do. Get you
with
a spray bottle in the house
and
mist yourself. Spritz, spritz,
exactly.
Spritz, spritz, and you're good right there.
Sully's so quiet. Sully, do you have AC? Is that why you're so quiet?
No, well, best Father's Day gift from a couple of years ago, Holly bought me one of those little portable ones that we just keep in the bedroom.
Oh, nice.
So that's great. Another thing that you can do, by the way, gee, you should try this. Fill up a cooler full of ice, if you can find any ice, and then put that one in front of your fan when you go to sleep, because as the cold air comes up out of the cooler, it'll blow on you. So that's another good one. That was an idea from the text line, too, to remind you.
Hey, lotion. Lotion on your feet and put some socks on. That works as well.
Really?
Yeah.
I learned something new from G-Scott.
Oh, yeah. You got to be good with that. You guys have a good one.
You too, G. You can ring my bell. Ring, your bell. This was a big week in the saga of Britney Spears, a pop star as a teenager, an international megastar in the years since. But her life has been controlled by what's known as a conservatorship. Since 2008. Rachel Bell joins us live with what happened this week.
Hi, Hannah. So, yeah, let me just give a little bit of background. So as you said, in 2008, Britney Spears has been under a conservatorship with her father, who she was not close with. And that means he has control over her person and her estate. So I'm going to play you a clip from the documentary Framing Britney Spears.
Conservatorships are a unique legal arrangement, usually designed for elderly people who are unable to take care of themselves or their money. The court gives someone else special powers to make decisions for them. It's unusual because Britney is so young and productive, but there's speculation that she may be dealing with mental illness issues or drug abuse issues. And it's sort of surprising in that Jamie wasn't a huge figure in her life before this. According to court records, Britney's conservators are able to control who can and cannot visit her and retain security guards for her 24 hours a day. They have the power to access her medical records and communicate with her doctors. They can take control of her house and even cancel her credit cards. They can make recording, touring, and TV deals for her and are deeply involved in her finances. There's some speculation that Britney may have basically accepted the conservatorship because she was worried about seeing her kids. And a few weeks later, she starts to get some visitation rights restored.
Okay, so as you can hear, usually this kind of thing is reserved for elderly people or someone who's completely mentally incapacitated. But over the past 13 years, Britney Spears has released albums, you know, made millions of dollars performing in Las Vegas. She's judged the X Factor. So clearly she has control of herself. So a couple days ago, she pleaded with the Los Angeles Superior Court judge to end this long-running conservatorship. She says she's been exploited, that she can't sleep, that she's depressed, that she cries every day. And she went to court with these four pages of notes that she read from that was released. And I'll just read you one of the quotes. She's talking about her father here. She says, he loved to control and hurt her. Excuse me. He loved to control to hurt his own daughter. He loved it. I worked 7 days a week, no days off, which in California, the only similar thing to this is called sex trafficking. Making anyone work against their will, taking all of their possessions away, credit card, cash, phone, passport, and placing them in a home where they work with the people who live with them. And she goes on to describe that she was forced to take medication every day, that they gave her drugs that made her feel like she couldn't really like talk, or, you know, that kind of made her incapacitated. So then they would say, oh, you're not well, you can't leave the house for a month, you can't see your children. So she said, I'm not happy, I can't sleep, I'm so angry, it's insane, and I'm depressed, I cry every day. And at this point, not only does she want to get out of this conservatorship, which judging from a lawyer who spoke in the documentary is extremely hard to do, she also wants to sue her family for taking away her autonomy and freedom for the past 13 years.
And I saw that documentary, and I'll tell you, I've never been a huge Britney Spears fan. I had heard a little about it, and I thought, oh, I'll just check it out for a minute. And I could not stop watching. She looked like a kidnap victim to me at the end of that. I had such a bad, just a bad overall feeling in general that, and it is reserved for older people. I know because I began that process with my grandmother before she passed away. And it's certainly not meant for what it's being held up for here. I mean, there's other avenues, right? If she's as bad as they say, there's the avenue of, you know, finding her incompetent and, you know, other kind of mental health treatments that are available. This seems like the most bizarre thing I've ever seen.
It does. And I mean, it goes on. She says that she can't even change her clothes without people in the room, that she is seen naked every single day. I mean, it is very, very scary. And, you know, I don't know if it was in the 60s or the 70s. I believe it was JFK who, you know, really loosened the laws for, it used to be really easy to just throw someone in a mental institution.
Like, and Francis, you know, right? Francis back in the 40s, I think, was an actress that happened to.
Yes, exactly. And so those laws were changed that now actually it's almost swung too far the other direction, that it's really hard to get somebody help if they need it. But this sounds like something that's kind of a loophole, you know, where it sounds like people can take complete control where they don't deserve it. So the documentary, I recommend anybody watch it. Even I thought it was really hard to watch. It was really, really sad. But you learn through it, which I learned watching the Amy Winehouse documentary, which both of these feel very similar. The media portrays Britney Spears, you know, remember when she shaved her head or she's walking into a gas station bathroom without shoes on. And it's just this whole message that she is crazy. And you have to remember that these are the angles that, you know, the paparazzi and these magazines spin to make a lot of money. When you watch the documentary, you start to understand why she did these things. You know, mm-hmm. the paparazzi was on her like they were on Princess Diana. It makes you claustrophobic to watch these scenes where there's dozens of people. She can hardly get in her car. She's covering her face. She's yelling that she's scared. And that's why she shaved her head, because she was trying to not be so beautiful and recognizable so right. she could have some peace.
Push them away. And I don't know, I can't remember if you've worked in L.A., but I worked in L.A. and I was at a story where there was paparazzi. It was a kind of a famous person's daughter had passed away, and I watched as they sent me out there, and there was all of the regular paparazzi near me, and they were trying to climb over this woman's fence, and it was the most, I was so disgusted being in that area. I mean, I didn't do what they were doing, but it was just horrible to watch. And when you watch that, what happens to Britney in that documentary, or see what happened to Princess Diana, all of those things that you mentioned, it's such a surreal thing that I can't imagine being in that position. So to try to push everyone away by making yourself less attractive, imagine having to think that way.
I know. And I think there's this idea in this country that, you know, if you're famous and you have a lot of money, you shouldn't complain about anything because look how great your life is. But I think they definitely should have some kind of regulations or protection and not allow the paparazzi to treat them this way. Because, you know, the other side of fame is how many people end up dying or, you know, many. Taking their own lives and having alcohol and drug issues. And it's so many people, you have to wonder that it must be getting to them. We know it's getting to them, but we always say, they're rich and famous and beautiful. Their lives must be great. So yeah, I think there needs to be a little bit more protection. And through this, I've been seeing a lot of articles that there are plenty of other conservatorships, not for famous people, mm-hmm. Where people are in the same situation. And so I think it's kind of an underlooked part of the law that most of us don't really know that much about that might be more under the microscope now.
Because if it can happen to this many people, to someone as famous as she is, imagine how many people it's happening to that don't get any coverage at all and how exactly. terrified they might be.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you, Rachel Bell.
Thank you, Hannah. Nice to chat with you.
You too.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.